netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Hi, and welcome to the FX Podcast. I'm John Montgomery. Our focus on this episode is F1 the movie, and our guest is Ryan Tudhope, production visual effects supervisor for the film. Now, while I'm obviously a big fan of blockbuster visual effects films like Star Wars and so forth, what I truly find compelling are invisible effects in films which help serve the storytelling. And F1 the movie is certainly an example of that. As though here in the podcast, there are a tremendous number of visual effects shots in the film, and the processes they follow to pull them off are really interesting. So with my decades-long love of both F1 and visual effects, I really enjoyed the discussion. Before we cross that, I just want to mention again that we have both audio and visual versions of this podcast. The video version is on the FX Guide YouTube channel, and the audio version is hosted on the FX Guide website. Take your pick. All right, so let's go ahead and cross the conversation between Mike and Ryan Tudhope.
Ryan, thanks so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Well, thanks so much for having me. Excited to chat with you.
Yeah, I really like this film. I really like F1, and I'm really intrigued to find out how you pulled it off. I have to say, actually, I don't know that racing films actually have the best reputation for being able to pull off what you guys have done. I know a lot of people sort of talk about it, but I seem to remember there have been quite a lot of films in the past that have really struggled to really connect, and you guys seem to have really nailed it.
It's challenging, I think, just from a story standpoint, because you typically have the drivers sort of behind the wheel by themselves, so you don't get the camaraderie of them being in a vehicle with another character. I think what Joe and Steven, our editor, did really well is keep the team connected to the driver, keep that story going, and then obviously bringing in the announcers and helping the audience through what was happening. So you have this feeling of being there. And that's obviously just for the races. You know, the rest of the story speaks for itself as well. But I think that, setting up the stakes, making it matter when they're on the track, when they're in the action, I think is important. But, you know, F1 is just such a, as you are a fan as well, I mean, it is just such a playground to make a film in. You know, I mean, it is the absolute best. The amount of, you know, when you're around these cars, they literally are like spaceships. I mean, the technology is just so far out there, and it's such the whole operation, not just the racing and stuff, but we got a chance to really embed ourselves with F1 for a few years, and getting to meet the men and women that travel around the world and put this effectively this show on in all these different cities and have it pulled off in the way it is it's fantastic. It was fantastic to be able to see what they do, and that's one of my biggest joys of working on movies like this is that connection to the real thing.
Yeah, my colleagues on the VFX show, and I'll come back to this in a second, but what was really interesting for me, they weren't really big F1 fans. They, you know, just weren't sort of so, I mean, being American, the American audiences, I don't know that they were as into it. But they then watched Silverstone after they'd seen F1, and they both commented just how much they enjoyed it and how much it kind of made sense, which actually I think really comes back to the visual effects, because you're trying to allow the audience to understand what's going on. And obviously there's, you know, narration from commentators and stuff, but actually making sure that you can be placed in the race. Otherwise you just get disengaged and you don't care. So that must have been the starting problem for you in terms of these visual effects.
Well, we wanted to make sure that there was a variety of sources for the material we were going to use. Joe had the idea really early on to rely on the broadcast cameras around the tracks to provide a lot of the racing footage, simply because, you know, these guys, they've got 30 cameras around the track on any given race. They're professionals at capturing that action. They all know each corner really well and what's happening in. There really just was no conceivable way we were going to put 30 production cameras around a track. And so, they worked really hard to capture that material. In fact, Apple had a whole team at each F1 race capturing the raw data streams from those cameras sort of prior to it being downgraded and going into a broadcast.
Oh, that's interesting.
So we captured all that data at a higher quality, which gave us the fidelity we needed as a starting point for using that material. And it really, I think that sort of ended up becoming one of the pieces of the puzzle. You know, my big belief about visual effects is that you want to have a variety of techniques that you rely on and that you cut between. And that's what keeps the audience on their toes. And so as I'm starting to kind of talk to the team about this, that in my head, that's what that starts to feel is, okay, we have this broadcast footage. That's going to be one really compelling way to tell this story, because they, so much of our philosophy, you know, for this film and films like Maverick is to get something in camera, even if we're going to change everything about that shot or a few things about that shot, to get as much as we can in camera so that it's, there's a real foundation. There's a real operator trying to track something that's really happening in the real world. And then we take it from there to modify that footage and add or remove or do whatever we need to do from a visual effects standpoint for the story. So the opportunity to rely on some of the broadcast footage for these races was huge, because immediately we knew, oh my gosh, that's going to look so authentic, because it literally is what we're used to seeing when we see these races. So then it just became a technical discussion with them about, they have a really skinny shutter on those cameras because it's important that they see all the advertising that they can and that things don't get too motion blurred. So we ran a bunch of tests and we were able to negotiate a more filmic shutter for certain races where it mattered. And like I said, we captured the data, really, really raw right off the camera. And so, you know, that kind of became a foundation. The other thing is that obviously a lot of that material is 50p, and our film is at 24. So there was a conversion process there as well. And some additional motion blur we had to add. So, you know, setting aside all the reskinning that we would do to that footage to get the continuity right, back to your original question of replacing different cars to work with whatever was occurring in the story, or put our Apex GP car into the mix. It really, you know, came down to that being a really important source of material for Stephen and Joe to be able to rely on.
Yeah, that point that you're making about the, I think it's like a really interesting one, because obviously, we're used to seeing very good footage live, but live has its own requirements, not least of which is, of course, you know, it needs to be broadcast. And so I think one of the examples of this is, if you had a camera in the car, then the camera is part camera, part transmitter, because you have to get that footage out to the audience because we want to see what happened as it's happening. Whereas once you moved to a production environment where you needed to capture the footage, maybe you want to monitor stuff, but you don't necessarily need the full bandwidth. So as I understand it, some of the cameras in the cars were basically taking over some of the space that we use for sending footage to record footage. Is that right?
Well, so our cars, our Apex GP cars, had a variety of camera mount locations that we were able to employ at any given time. So we started really early working with Joe and his cinematographer, Claudio Miranda, on figuring out where these cameras would go on our cars. Claudio is really savvy with 3D, and so he had his own mock-ups of where the cars, you know, where the cameras would go and what those lenses would be. And we took a lot of that and we brought it into an Unreal environment. And we actually did a matchimation of one of Lewis Hamilton's track laps at Silverstone. So we had sort of one of his really fast laps, the race line. And we put some other cars around him and we sort of created this game engine version of a Lewis Hamilton lap. And then we were able to put the camera mounts into that world to show Joe and Claudio, here's what this lens would look like. Here's what this frame would be. Here's what it actually looks like going down that straight, or when you put another car kind of battling here. Because a lot of times these lenses are pretty wide, so you get a lot of distortion on the edges. And so you kind of want to find the right lens there. So it really was a really important tool for them to be able to get confidence that they had made the right decisions, right, about where these cameras were going to go, because the next step was that those positions, that model went to Mercedes AMG, who was one of our partners in helping us build the real cars, our real race cars. And they had to engineer, we basically just said, here's where we want the cameras. And then the smart men and women at Mercedes had to figure out, okay, well, this thing's going to be going 180 miles an hour or 150 miles an hour, whatever it is. We need to make this safe. And they had to figure out how to connect those camera positions into the chassis and then obviously engineer where they were going to put the batteries, the recording, all the RF equipment that you were talking about and all that. So it was really important to get that right from the get-go. And obviously there was a huge investment and months and months and months of work after we had sort of picked them to get that right.
Yeah, I mean, while we're still discussing this idea of source that you had to work with before we actually turn to what you did with that, one of the things that struck me is the vibration problem, right? Like, it's not just a matter of putting a camera anywhere. It's like getting camera footage that looks good. And then on top of that, these cameras, especially the Sony ones on the cars, had the ability to pan, which I think really added to the production value. But 100%. Oh, and Paul Focus with Preston Motors. I mean, it's really impressive. But that footage is only useful if either it's stable enough or you can post-process it to make it stable enough. Was it clean enough to use, or did you have to do a lot of processing to kind of make it work?
No, we spent a lot of time testing those rigs. Sam, our key grip, worked really closely with Claudio on finding the right amount of dampening on them so that, you know, the goal was to keep just the right amount of energy in them. There were times where things kind of got a little wonky and we had to bring the cars in and look at it, try to fix it. For the most part, they had it slightly on the smoother side. Okay. What we ultimately wanted, and then in post-production we would add shake as needed for the moment in the story that shot took place. So we were never really burdened with anything that we had to rescue from too much shake, if that makes sense.
So having established how much went into the authentic capture, I think most people would also be shocked to discover how many shots in the whole film, obviously not all of them racing, were VFX shots. What was the shot count?
2,500 was our final shot count.
Which honestly is, okay, so firstly, it's a great compliment to you. I didn't pick that was anywhere near that number. But secondly, the one shot that my colleagues criticized, which I'm going to now fess up, you know about this, had a discussion about, was actually a shot you didn't touch at all.
You should have called me, man.
But notwithstanding our humble apologies for that, but it does draw attention to something that is relevant, which is in this environment with artificial lighting, which a racetrack has, especially on the night races, and the enormous amount of that lighting and the way it's going, I wondered how many times, it's like you're not necessarily going for a natural look, and in a sports context, we just believe it. But like take any sport, right? Like I was watching football the other night. There are just no shadows where the players are standing because there are so many lights that it kind of floods out where a shadow would go around their feet, which is completely unnatural in any other setting. You must have had the same phenomenon with the cars, right? Which is like getting everything to like look right, given that I have expectations about shadows and reflections and blah, blah, blah. But in that artificial setting, sometimes it just doesn't look like I'd be used to. That makes sense?
Yeah, it does make sense. Yeah. Well, there's a couple of things we should touch upon on those. I think you're referring to, there was some shots of fireworks in the pit lane at Abu Dhabi. And there was a couple of things that you guys got wrong there that I think are worth touching upon in the context of this question. So obviously the first, I emailed you right away. The first was that those were actually completely in camera.
Oh, yeah.
And so they weren't even numbered as visual effects shots, right? We didn't even touch them for any reason whatsoever. But the other thing, and I think maybe the bigger thing, is that there was sort of a reference to the fact that they must have looked that way because they were reshoots or we had to go back and do something. And neither of those things could be further from the truth. In fact, what's so impressive about those shots, and I don't question them because I was standing there when we filmed them, so I know they're real. So I think in my lizard brain, I'm just like, yeah, that's real. I was there. I saw it. But if you think about it, and as an F1 fan, I think you'll appreciate this as well, is that what that actually is this crazy, hugely orchestrated thing from our ADs and our cast and everyone who basically was waiting in our garage at the end of the 2024 race season, right? This big deal for F1. And right as the cars went through the track, they rushed out onto the pit lane with our cameras tracking them, fireworks going off in the background for real. All the other teams were running out there too. It was literally the real end of the 2024 season. So you know, in contrast to this notion that it was like a reshoot or something, it was actually this really impressive thing that our team pulled off multiple times as filmmakers. I think in terms of how do we film around this live event, how do we try to capture as much real as we can, not be in the way, but still try to capture those things. Now, you know, to your point, you're kind of just given the lighting you're given in those situations. You're given the world you're given. And I actually think that one of the reasons why this film and films like Maverick, you know, there's one of the components of why people walk away and feel that so much of it is real is because Claudio, our cinematographer, just does an incredible job with the natural light. He does a really good job.
Absolutely.
Of working with what's there. And you don't feel, you know, anything that you add to a movie that is artificial, and that can be costume, it can be lighting, it can be visual effects, obviously, all of those things can start to add up. And I think that one of the things that he does is he just isn't just a real, you know, expert at making that stuff look cinematic, but be natural and really kind of grounded. And I think that it plays really well for these types of films. And so, you know, there's always conversations about, he is cognizant and we are cognizant about which direction are we shooting for the right time of day, and how do we, you know, maximize the light for a particular situation. And then obviously Joe and Steven are also making the selects of what goes in the edit based on those types of things and what looks good too. But yeah, I mean, I think the fact that the lighting is not forced is one of the components that helps me out as a visual effects supervisor. Helps me out a lot too, because it sort of, again, adds to that foundation of realism that that really helps us a lot.
I mean, he really threaded the needle, right? Because it has to look like F1 because we watch it every time it's on. And it has to look cinematic because we're at the movie theater. We want to, you know, we've got movie stars, right? And if it had cut between kind of overly gorgeous hero actor lighting and pit lane stuff, you'd have gone, well, hang on a second, that was filmed in the studio and that wasn't, which doesn't feel like that at all. Okay, so
it's funny because I'm working with the gaffer who was on F1 right now, and he said to me the other day, he's like, you know, you haven't really seen me have to light things too much, because when on F1, we really were kind of just working with what we had so much. So yeah, it's part of the style, you know. I think it is part of what makes those films what they are, and it's just part of the look. So we try to honor that we can in the visual effects world.
So now let's, if we can, zero in on how you solve the problem of the cars. Because obviously, as much as you had access and brilliant access at that, we didn't have, you know, the Apex car in the middle of a race that was a real race, right? Okay, so I think there's probably a few strategies that you took there. Can we start with the idea of actually reskinning a car that was in an actual race as a first point?
Yeah. So this actually goes all the way back to before the movie was even greenlit. Joe was talking to F1 about how we might pull this off and what technology we might employ. And he had the idea to take some of the footage from, I believe it was 2022 Silverstone, and demonstrate sort of our Top Gun methodology of taking a vehicle and changing it to something else. And so we got the footage from F1 at pretty high quality, and we cut together a little 5-shot sequence. And then I had our team at Framestore do a reskin sort of test, essentially, turning at the time we sort of cut together a little sequence with Lewis Hamilton with his car that was kind of doing a little action sequence. And we reskinned that as our Apex GP car, or what we thought it might look like at that time in those early days. And that actually became a bit of a show and tell for Joe to be able to use to convince some of the stakeholders that this is how we are going to put our car into real footage, and how this is going to honor the authenticity of the sport and all the things that were important to kind of getting the film off the ground. So one of the things we learned from that early test was that the tracking was absolutely crazy hard. In fact, it required some of our best trackers to be able to get to figure out what the cameras were doing, because they're zooming and they're on these really long lenses and they're panning through things that you don't really know where you are in the world. And it's really hard to figure out. And so we sort of brute forced it in that early test. But it was one of the things that I knew I had to solve for the team as we went into production. We were going to be facing thousands of shots. So we brought on Clear Angle Studios, and we brought them around the world, and we scanned all of these tracks that were key to our story down to millimeter accuracy. They spent the night, usually it was at night because we were filming during the day. And so they would work their way all the way around the track, and they would do a huge LiDAR scan of everything just to get all the undulations right, get all the geometry of it, where everything was. We also ran a drone around, and kind of it would circle around the track all the way around to take textures to kind of, you know, paste onto all that geometry. And so we were just trying to capture the world as best we could. And then the last thing we captured was an 8-camera array that we would run around the track with a stunt driver following the race lines. We were sort of positioned properly on the tracks. And we ran that with a really skinny shutter. So I was effectively just taking 24 pictures per second of the world. And we did that on race weekends. So we had all of the signage. Sometimes there was crowd in the stands. It would depend on when that lap happened and who was kind of at the, you know, bathroom or actually in their seats. But the combination of all of that data sort of was the foundation that our visual effects teams would then sort of rely on to figure out where are these cameras, these broadcast cameras in particular, where are they panning? Where are they zooming? What do we do? And that gave us the ability to match-mate the vehicles, match-mate the camera, and essentially recreate a 3D environment for lighting to put our super shiny reflective cars back into so that they would, you know, behave properly and look right when they were in the shots.
That eight camera rig was just like shooting 360 effectively at high resolution and just giving you that detail you needed, right?
That's right. Yeah. It was sort of I think it was three cameras front, four cameras back. I had to get it down to the eyeline height of an F1 driver, which is 50 centimeters off the deck, real low. So we sort of split the rig of front and back, and we ran one up as well, just for a reflection environment. So that sort of,
I was going to, like, normally you'd put it like out the back or the top of a car or something, but you'd like way out of where you'd want to be for helmet reflections.
Way out of where you'd want to be. Yeah. And we can get to it in a minute, but there was some situations where we actually had to do full track swapping and digital environments because we couldn't film at the right track where we wanted to. And so that array vehicle and all of that data became obviously really instrumental there as well. Which we can talk to, that was Monza, but that sort of became the foundation. And then, you know, in the broadcast footage, we were swapping in our Apex GP car, obviously. That was sort of the primary thing. The primary idea was that we would put our car into the race and we would put the race cars into our footage, right? That's the basic idea of it. But from a continuity standpoint, Joe and Steven would find shots that had the right action and the right camera move and worked well in the edit, but it wasn't necessarily the right order of cars. And so we ended up replacing quite a few of the other teams as well. And, you know, the F1 teams were not, we didn't even ask if we could scan their cars or photograph them because we just knew that wasn't going to happen. And we didn't want to go down that road. So we sort of treated the other cars, which we knew we had to build and capture, as if we were press. And we kind of stood in the pit lane and tried to steal photos of them. And we got grid access before the races, and we would walk around the cars and get photos of them.
But for someone that doesn't know, they might assume that an F1 car looks the same throughout all the races, but an F1 car absolutely doesn't look the same race to race. I mean, we're not talking about modifications. Though that's one thing. We're actually just talking about signage and like advertising.
The liveries.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And their helmets as well. And that really, that kind of caught us off guard a little bit. If there was one thing we didn't plan for enough of, it was the number of asset variants that we were going to require. And it was really important to us to have every, you know, if there is a car and a driver in a race in our movie that, and their CG, they are in the right livery and they are wearing the right helmet for that particular race. And that was in and of itself, an entire process of tracking all of that and making sure those assets were ready to go. But then, you know, on our Apex GP car that we built, we had obviously digital versions of that. We had some CAD data because we built it for real. So we were obviously able to leverage some of that. We also scanned our car. And then I had Keith Dawson, who was our, special effects supervisor. He kindly built a huge turntable that we were effectively able to crane our Apex GP car on top of. And then we set up a camera just like you would a digital turntable, and we slowly spun the Apex car in the same lighting. And then I was able to put that side by side with our digital car. We also ran up on it with some steady cams and did some other things. But this is sort of, I did this on Maverick. It was a little more impressive because I actually had them rotate an F-18 on the tarmac for me, which was more fun. But you know, I'm a big believer in the assets being a huge part of the success of the visual effects in a film like this. I think that when you get when you can put the cars side by side and no one can tell the difference between them, and you've gone through that, you've done that homework at that time, then you know that it's going to work in a variety of lighting situations. You're going to be able to you know, the worst nightmare is you finally get it working in one race, but then you try to put the cars in a different lighting situation and they don't look real anymore. And you're like, oh my God, how do we fix this? And you end up, so you know, it's getting it right from the get-go. And so I spend a lot of time thinking about what can I provide the team to give them what they need to make that possible.
So I understood that there was an F2 car used, right? So
yeah, well, there was F2 and F3. So our cars, our Apex GP cars, were built on an F2 chassis that was actually Graham built cars. It was extended a bit.
Yeah.
So it got close to the wheelbase of an F1, not quite, but it helped. And then, and so the, that was our F2 cars, and they had a variety of engines. We had mechachrome engines. We had, you know, electric engines. If we needed to just do pit lane stops, we could kind of do that on an electric motor. So we had a variety. They built about six, at least six, I might have that number wrong, Apex GP cars that we use as picture cars. And then we had F3 cars that we used as stand-ins for our cars when we were doing stunts that were too dangerous for the cars or might damage them. So if we needed to send our car into the gravel or do anything that, you know, the team felt was potentially putting it at risk, then we, that's when we would employ our F3 cars when we have them driven.
So if the production shot the F2 modified car, was it, to all intents and purposes, in camera, or was like no matter what they did, you would still need to do a few things digitally just to bring it in line with what you wanted to present as an F1?
So the tires on F2 cars are skinnier than F1 cars, like sort of width wise. So we whenever we could see that, we would fix that. We would widen them. There was, you know, a lot of times there's camera rigs on them, things like that. So it was clean. I would say it was minor augmentations and cleanup. And things like that. There was, but for the most part, they were, you know, if you think about it, they were in camera from a standpoint of.
Yeah, I was going to say, there had to be a bunch of cleanup work because apart from anything else, you know, if there was a shot that happened to be great, but it had one of your remote control cameras sitting to the right, we'd, you know, see it a million miles away. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and there was all the RF antennas and things like that that needed to go on there. Because one of the things that was really, you know, different about this film versus Maverick is that we were able to see the footage from our cars as we were filming it. So there was a whole RF team that did an amazing job dropping RF receivers all the way around the tracks. And then back in Mission Control, Joe and Claudio and the whole team could see the footage in real time. They could operate the cameras. They could pull focus. We were there while it was happening. On Maverick, we would send the jets off and, you know, go to craft service for half hour while we waited for them to come back. But on this one, we were able to be more engaged in that. And I think that that's, you know, Joe's ultimately, when you see those pans, that's Joe watching and saying, pan now, you know, or, you know, pull, you know, look forward. Or, and so he's literally, he knows the action. He knows what he's building as a sequence and he's directing the team to kind of work with cameras as they're happening.
If we move away from hardcore racing footage to those areas that would, in any other context and in every context need to be visual effects for just pure safety reasons. There are accidents in this. There are, you know, stunts. And obviously there's, you know, things that you wouldn't want to do. Did you have to resort? I mean, you must have had to have resort to fully digital cars at some point, right? Or was it like...
Oh, yeah. 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 I mean, so anytime we used an F3 car that was reskinned as a digital, they're basically digital cars. This reskinning process and putting the digital car in there. There's also, you know, we had, like I said, six Apex cars. So if we knew that our character was battling a Ferrari or Red Bull or whatever it was, I would try to get another car to play that character. So we were filming something and that they would choreograph that and we would have another car out there that would act as a lighting reference and performance reference, and we would replace that digitally. But there were times when the car wasn't there at all, and we had to animate that place, and that certainly happened. But that was not the goal. I mean, the goal was always to try to have something there if possible. Yeah.
But I mean, when we were talking reskinning earlier, like there's a Williams car that's got reskinned to an Apex car. Mm. And that is what when I say reskinning for those that are listening, we mean literally like it's the same. It's like you've changed the livery on it effectively and changed it, but you're not taking away the car completely. Then there's the sort of a second stage where you're saying, well, that's exactly where I want the car to be. And you can track it and see how it moves, but you're going to replace it fully with a different car. And then there's presumably this third category where you just say, look, you know, I need a car to spin off here or whatever. And it's just going to be a completely digital.
That's fairly right. Yeah. I mean, the reskinning process is more intensive, I think, than like in the sense we're not using the geometry. The cars are designed so differently, even the teams, every team, you know, all the side pods are different shapes and everything is different. And they're all very different than our Apex car was designed because it was sort of, we tried to work that design into an F2 chassis.
Let's face it. Yours was built for combat.
It was built for combat. It was a little meaner looking, right? So when we talk about reskinning, I mean, effectively what we're doing is we're putting our digital car, whatever it needed to be, in the place of that other car. Our animators and matchmation artists are doing a really good job of trying to capture the performance, not only of the car and the wheels and suspension, but also the driver. So we're using it as sort of a matchmation reference and a lighting reference. And then we effectively paint out what we need to, if it's outside the edges of our digital car, if it, you know, is bigger or anything like that. And then we render our new car in its place. We had two versions. The other thing is that, you know, like we were talking about, we did extend the chassis of the F2 cars, our real cars, a bit, but it still didn't reach the length of a real F1 car. And so in shots where we were putting our Apex car into the mix of all these other real F1 cars, we had a variant of our car that was actually the correct length for F1. So it was sort of, it only existed digitally, but it was an F1 sized version of our car, so that when you see them all apples to apples in a shot, it doesn't look like ours is short, you know?
Well, and that would be particularly the case in the pre-start position, where you've just got shots of them, normally at the back of the grid, you know, like you can see it very, very clearly from those either drone or helicopter shots. And it's, you know, it would be incredibly obvious if it wasn't looking the right dimensions.
Exactly.
And then on top of all of that, I presume that there had to be some crowd work and stuff as well, right? Because while you were filming at real F1s, I can't imagine you got all the crowds and all of the reaction crowd stuff that you needed the way that you would otherwise get.
Tons of crowd and signage, right? Because obviously these F1 events are full of sponsors. That's part of what our array vehicle was capturing for us in terms of documenting what was there. So we could honor the sponsors and get all those signs back. Because what happens is we would get these track laps during race weekends, but they might be in the morning of, you know, Saturday, or it might be, sometimes they were kind of right when we wanted them, but the grandstands might be half full or whatever the case may be. And then there was, you know, a race weekend's really only 3 days. There was sometimes weeks of filming at any one location. And for all that other filming, there was nothing there, right? The in some cases, even the grandstands were removed. And so a huge amount of the work that the team did was absolutely, it was trying to restore that F1 event, that atmosphere, from crowds, signage, grandstands, everything that we needed to make it feel like it happened during the actual race. We ended up building a fully fledged 3D crowd system. We didn't try to do any sort of plates or tiles, except in rare cases where we had a lock off or felt like we could kind of rely on something like that. We just knew that the lighting was going to be changing so much. Also, these cars are moving in a really compound way around the track, and kind of things are rotating and perspectives changing. And so there really was no way for us to do any sort of easy solution there. So we ended up going with a full-fledged crowd system, but the team did a great job. They did a lot of those performances in the crowd that you see are the artists that were building it and doing all that performance capture in-house.
You made a reference to Monza earlier. What was that in regard to? You said you'd come back to that.
Yeah, Monza. Well, Monza was a really unique challenge in the sense that the story called for rain. First of all, it's a story. It's, you know, in the story, rain comes in the middle of the race, which, you know, during pre-production and kind of planning, we didn't know what we were going to get when we ended up going down to Italy. We all assumed it was going to not rain in summertime. But we actually did some early tests where we took some footage and we did a digital wet down. We added the rooster tails and all the water spray, and we showed Joe and the team that we could rely on that, or that we would likely need to rely on that. And it looked really convincing. But, you know, there was other, because of the fact that we kind of filmed this over two seasons of F1, we didn't have our cast in the first time we went to Monza, so we weren't able to shoot any of the cast footage in the cars. We were only able to do stunt work at that time. And so when we came back to Europe to film the rest of the season, that particular track was undergoing, I think they were getting a new, they were doing something. We couldn't film there. It was, I think they were kind of relaying the asphalt or something, trying to get ready for the race. And so we ended up filming a lot of the material that we needed for Monza at Silverstone, and then relying on that array that we shot and the LiDAR that we did and all the geometry, we were able to build digital versions of the backgrounds to replace Silverstone for Monza. But then we also had all of the water and digital wet downs and all the water spray and all that stuff to add on top of the dry footage. One of the things that was really, I think in hindsight, great about the fact that we shot that stuff dry for wet was that it allowed us to hold that philosophy and carry it through that sequence, that philosophy of filming something for real. And again, using visual effects to change it however we needed to. In that case, it was sometimes the environment or making it look like it was a storm had come in. You know, you wouldn't be able to get what we got, I think, from the standpoint of just safety. Those cars are really hard to handle in water. We knew we couldn't wet the track down because, you know, you can't turn around on a track. So if you send the water truck, you know, down the 8-kilometer track, by the time it got back again, it would be dry. So it's kind of, there was no way to really work with any sort of wet down circumstance. So it ended up being a really good solution, I think, to be able to rely on, again, that in-camera approach, even though in that particular sequence, there was a lot more kind of environmentally the visual effects had to do.
Yeah, I mean, just by the nature of the cars, if a car's, an F1's going through a wet track, it puts up a ridiculous volume of water in terms of spray, right?
It does. Yeah. And Lewis actually looked at us, see some of the shots that were progressing early on, and we had all gone pretty full bore into how much water we were putting into the shots. There's obviously, as you said, there's references all over the place of these, you know, it's crazy how much water. And so we were sort of heading in that direction. In the story, our characters, Joshua Pierce and also Verstappen in that case, they stay on slicks. They don't come into the pit and put on their intermediates. And so that's essential to the story. And Lewis looked at the footage and he said, there's just no way they would die. Like, there's no way that you could have that much water and be on slicks. So we need to bring it way back. And so that was one of his, I think, really valid notes. And so our team worked really hard to kind of re-sim stuff and kind of, cause you can't really just fade that down in the comp. You need to re-sim it to be a lesser amount of water and get all and redial everything to make it look real again. Which we did. So we ended up sort of also, we allowed half the track to be wetter than the other half where the actual accident takes place in the story. Assuming that maybe the weather came in over there and it's dumping, but it's a little more dry over there. So we were able to justify certain things, but yeah, it just shows again, kind of that what's so fun about these films and learning about these worlds is the pursuit of authenticity and really getting, you know, caught up in it and wanting to do it right.
Yeah. I think that's one of the really fascinating things. I mean, it's not just, fan kind of service here. There were two things that came out around the time the film was coming out that I thought was really interesting about input that you got one of them was that a real driver can actually tell what gear they're in just by the sound. But the second thing was that two of the McLaren drivers were listening to just their audio of their engines and could pick which track it was based on just the sound of their engines. So they had no visuals, no other reference, and just the amount of gear changes and how long till the gear change happened meant that they could pick it, which track it was. Each of them picked exactly which track it was over the season, right? So when you say that you took Silverstone and made it look like a different track, for those that don't know Formula One, you think, oh, well, you know, you might change some buildings behind kind of thing. But these corners, these individual corners are like known by fans as much as they are almost by drivers. Yeah. So you don't get to just put in a couple of signs in the background and sell a translation between ones. I mean, it must have been quite a lot of work to nail that.
Oh, 100%. Yeah, you have to get it right for obvious reasons. And the, you know, we went through this process where we would essentially give our editor these what we call bubbles. And so we would take the performance in the foreground that we had of our cast or whoever it was, and we would very quickly sort of do a mock-up using our array footage and drop it in the background and sort of find the right, it was an editorial sort of, you know, step of like, is this the right range of this track? We're coming into this corner or we're leaving this corner or this particular sign's going past us. And it was really just sort of an A over B. The perspective wasn't right, but it was enough to sort of get an approval of, yep, that looks like that's going to work in the edit. And then the team, you know, it was a painstaking process, obviously a huge amount of people involved to get that footage actually into a perspective correct, you know, world where, because, you know, there's all kinds of parallax. There's trees and things going in front of stuff and getting the motion blur of all that right. And you're essentially building a 3D environment. It's effectively a 3D environment with certain projections and building it up as best you can with the material you have. But it took a while to get those right, those bubble shots. And, you know, we have the real thing that you're cutting against. So you kind of can, that's part of what we do when we're looking at how everything is coming together in the sequence is what bumps and what sticks out. And you kind of just keep working at it until nothing does. But yeah, that process was really, I think, critical to the making of the movie or making some of the sequences work was being able to transpose them into different tracks. There was other times where it was much easier. We could do it because our mount positions are sort of fixed, you know, they are what they are. And so if we had footage of a stunt driver doing a particular thing, we could always swap in sort of in a more 2D way footage from the same mount camera. So there was lots of those sorts of splits, more traditional splits as well. But
we're obviously talking about visual effects, but the editorial on this is just a masterpiece in its own right, because the shooting ratio must have been through the roof.
Like, Steven is amazing. Our VFX editor, Latham, I need to give a big shout out to. I mean, she was on top of so much continuity stuff. I mean, if you know, we haven't even gotten into the tire colors and how they are need to be correct from every shot and every moment of the sequence. And, you know, just tracking all these little details, you know, we didn't get everything perfect. But usually we knew when we were letting something go. There was such a great team involved in kind of keeping an eye on everything that we all knew when we were like, that's okay. That one's for one of the super fans to catch, you know. But it was a lot of work from the editorial team and also as you said, just going through all the mountains of footage that they had to do. There's a really amazing podcast that Stephen was just on where you really get a good sense of what he and his team pulled off. It's very impressive.
Yeah. I mean, it's keeping track of that is so vital, but also conceptually, you're not just keeping track of what was, it's where it's going, right? Like, in other words, you're taking footage from here and putting it there kind of thing. It would have been a huge requirement. So presumably you're working just at a 4K high dynamic range. Is that the kind of your base file?
Yeah, our 4K was our final delivery. A lot of the footage was shot, you know, 6K or 8K. So we had some wiggle room. But ultimately, we delivered the show 4K. And
what was your base renderer that you were doing the 3D in? Like, what were you rendering in?
I think Framestore was using sort of a homegrown version of Arnold, if I'm not mistaken. They have their own system that looks amazing. And then I'm not sure what ILM was using. We should talk about ILM real quick because they did some amazing work at the beginning of the movie in Daytona. They owned that whole Daytona sequence along with a variety of other things like the flashback with the 1990s McLaren that goes into the wall and some of the VHS look and things like that. So they were a great partner on the film as well. As far as their renderer, I'm not sure, but just such a great team to work with. Everything just looked amazing. It was a real pleasure. And it was really great to be able to split the show up in that way where we had sort of that, it was a different, you know, it was a clean break, a different vibe that we were going for in that part of the movie. And they just did a really great job of capturing that messiness, that dirtiness that you have from that Rolex 24 and just kind of all that.
It really was spectacular, that Daytona footage. And I'm glad you highlighted that because it has obviously different cars. There's a sort of a cultural difference, if you like. And then there's this kind of, as you say, grittiness kind of, you know, endurance kind of sentiment about the nature of it. So it's not exactly the same thing at a different track. It's actually kind of its own beast. And by the way, its own lighting challenges, right? Because of the range of what's being shot.
Yeah, it was just a different. Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, being there was really helpful just in sort of capturing the vibe and being able to bring that dirtiness into the shots we do. And we have the sequence where, you know, he knows that one of the cars is going to have oil trouble, that they're having some engine problems. And so we have the splatter of oil that comes on our windshield. And, you know, there's lots of reskinning throughout that sequence as well. There's a couple of full CG car shots that we just couldn't do practically, but there's a ton of really amazing practical work in that sequence too. And in fact, that's the foundation of it. Our stunt drivers were just absolutely incredible, what they were able to pull off and our cast. I mean, some of the stuff that they were doing, what Brad was doing in those cars was just amazing. It was absolutely amazing.
We talked about Lewis Hamilton being, of course, a producer and so key, but they were similarly on Daytona. They were like key drivers as well. Like, you had the same, different drivers, of course, but same level of like high quality input.
Yeah, well, and the other thing that we were able to do in Daytona, much like we did on the F1 sequences, is that Joe was able to get a camera into a car in the real Rolex 24. So we had sort of these over-the-shoulder shots of a real driver in the race, and he was wearing the costume of Brad. And so we had again sort of this mix and match of the real thing to our production work, and a variety of. Again, a variety of techniques that try to pull it all together.
Were you doing face replacements then to get Brad into the Daytona cars, or how did that work?
Well, the only thing we would do on those is we'd put Brad's face in the rearview mirror. So okay. We would sort of we'd do a face replace inside the reflection of the driver. So you'd have this really fun shot of a real driver in the real Rolex 24, but there's the reflection of Brad, so it feels like he's the one driving it. Otherwise, what's happening there is you're seeing stunt driving with Brad and the stunt drivers doing really crazy stuff. And then we're filling out the field around them or, you know, in some cases, reskinning. We had some other cars that Graham Kelly, our car expert, brought into the mix there. And we also had digital versions of all those cars that we could add to the field, or we could reskin if we needed to. And there was also some sensitivity around what teams we were featuring in terms of, you know, their other cars breaking down and stuff. So we had to do some changes there and things like that. So,
yeah, it's a curious problem, isn't it? Because I imagine every team, especially their sponsors, is very happy to be in a film. But by the same token, it's not very easy to portray any other team as being kind of negligent, bad, evil, or just downright incompetent, because why the heck would they want to be associated with
that's
that?
That's right. Well, that's the genius of Joe's storyline here and how he, you know, was able to make it more about our team and not about the other team. And I think that's the only way that this would have been done like that. So,
yeah, I mean, I just think it's magnificent. I just adored it. Obviously, I adored it. But also, I just was so impressed with how well you pulled off the effects. Because as I said, I would never have picked that level of that number of effects. And I kind of knew, I'd been reading everything, I'd been watching, you know, people reporting on you guys filming it at events leading up to the film even coming out, right? And those stolen moments that you'd have. In fact, somebody, which I thought was very funny, paid you the ultimate compliment that they were like, the most unrealistic thing in this film, and it stood out, was that when the drivers were walking back through the paddock, people weren't stopping for selfies with them. Everything else was believable. That was the only thing that wasn't believable. Because these days they can't move without autographs and selfies. Yeah.
As you know, it's a huge team effort. I have to give huge props to our producer, Nakia Ford. She was just such a supportive figure in helping us get everything we needed and making everything run smoothly. And then, you know, we had, I had Rob Harrington running the London team and frame store, Nico Chevalier in Montreal. Those guys were my right hand and left hand. I think their passion and the entire team's passion to try to make this stuff, you know, our goal is really to be supporting. I mean, really, we felt like this isn't about the visual effects standing out in any way. This is about people just watching the material and believing that those races are happening. And I knew when we would watch reels and we were working on the process, and I would forget what we did. I would watch through and I would sort of stop thinking about the cars in the footage, and I just didn't even. I knew that we had gotten to a point where we needed to be. And it's really a huge testament to those guys and the whole team and what they were able to do with what we had. And so I'm just so humbled by all.
So just in finishing up, Maverick took a lot of like clever steps forward in this whole kind of thing. Okay, F1's taken more steps. I mean, a classic example being able to monitor and control those cameras because you're not flying away from where base camp is. Yeah. Lessons learned from this, like, is there another step that would naturally occur to you in hindsight? Now you're going, well, if we were trying another attempt at a different sport or a different whatever, the thing that I would have liked on this one and I'd love to try on the next one?
That's a really tough question. I mean, there was certain like drone and like swarming stuff that I always wondered if there was like, if that's some way to elevate this. We're talking kind of like, you know, sky's the limit at the moment, but like being able to pre-program camera moves and be able to kind of like have cameras that are following certain action and sort of You know, there was this really incredible drone that came out during photography that was faster than an F1 car. I think it like overtakes one of the Red Bulls. They showed some material of that. So maybe it's something sort of in the camera technology that you level up a bit. I mean, ultimately, you know, I think that there's something, again, if you go back to what we were talking about earlier about just how authentic and grounded it is, I think that's why it works. I think as soon as you start to you know, this is why I'm not the one designing those cameras, because like that would take it into a whole nother direction. And it's, I think it's really more about how grounded and realistic it is and being with the drivers and being with them in those tough moments. And so I don't know that you need to level up in that way.
I mean, that is the accomplishment, isn't it? Because we're with the drivers, we get a sense of their acting. I mean, in reality, you've got just a slit where their eyes are between their fireproof, balaclavas and through the helmets and stuff. The very fact that we even sort of feel like we're in the is a huge accomplishment at so many levels.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. It was such a pleasure to be a part of. It was an amazing, amazing film, amazing team. So it was a real pleasure.
Well, thanks so much for taking time to talk to us about this, Ryan. We really appreciate it. Thanks, mate.
Appreciate it. Thanks for staying up late. I appreciate it as well.
Well, thanks, guys, for that. As I mentioned in the opening, I've been a fan of F1 for a while now, way back before it reached its current popularity, thanks in large part to Drive to Survive. And it's actually my VFX background as a flame artist that led me getting hooked on it initially. Back in the day, I was invited to Montreal by the flame team and had amazing VIP seats at the start-finish line for the Montreal Grand Prix. And seeing my first standing start and race in person, I got hooked, and I've been a fanboy ever since, thanks to being a flame artist. Well, that's it for this episode. For Mike Seymour, I'm John Montgomery. Thanks for listening or watching this FX podcast.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by clicking the Contact Us link at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.